What if two seemingly opposing philosophies, Islam and anarchism, actually share some really profound connections?
Yeah, like what if the roots of true freedom and community, lie in this unexpected blend? Spirituality and social order mixed together.
It's a question that might just flip your understanding of both right on its head.
Definitely.
So today we're taking a deep dive into this pretty extraordinary idea. It's presented in source material called Islam as Mystic Anarchism.
And look, this isn't about saying Islam is anarchism, full stop.
Right.
It's more subtle. We're exploring a powerful analogy here, looking at these surprising overlaps, the shared currents underneath.
And hopefully that helps us dismantle some common myths about both along the way.
Exactly.
So our mission today is to unpack how this perspective really challenges, our standard ideas about religion, authority, society.
You'll probably discover concepts that might, well, turn your perception of these fields upside down.
Offering some powerful insights into what it means to be truly liberated, but also interconnected.
Okay, so where do we start?
Let's begin with the core meaning of Islam itself. The word Islam, it means submission, right? Or surrender. But submission to what exactly?
That's the absolute crucial point that source emphasizes. This submission is solely to Allah,
Okay.
understood as the unique, the eternal, the uncreated reality. It's a fundamental distinction, really underpins everything else.
And if that submission is only to Allah, I mean, what does that imply radically about any human claims to power or authority?
Well, it implies a complete rejection. No submission to any temporary created human power.
Right.
No institutions, no specific individuals holding that kind of ultimate authority. The source actually highlights an Arabic phrase, La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah.
Okay, and what does that mean?
It powerfully translates to something like, there is no force or power save in Allah.
Wow.
It's not just a theological statement,
Yeah.
It's a really profound declaration against human dominion.
So Allah is described as the sole king, the only legislator, the ultimate owner.
Exactly. Which means no human being, no institution can claim that absolute power. They can't legislate without limit or truly own anything absolutely.
For many people, though, this idea of purely divine authority, maybe without human interpretation or enforcement, it might sound like chaos. How does the source deal with the practical side, like governance, if no human has absolute power?
Yeah, that's a critical point you raise.
No.
The source argues Allah is also described with attributes like peace, as-salam, justice, al-adl, wisdom, al-hakim.
Okay.
And it points out that all human claims to these qualities, they're relative, they're imperfect. So this isn't about chaos. It's actually a direct refutation, a pushback against any human attempt to control life or its processes, under the banner of some political project.
That really lays the groundwork for understanding the anarchist critique, then.
Precisely. And you see this reinforced in a really powerful hadith that's a saying or tradition of the Prophet, where Allah challenges kings on the day of resurrection, asking, where are the kings? Where are the oppressors? It really hammers home that ultimate authority belongs only to the divine.
Fascinating. So if Islam fundamentally rejects human dominion in that way, how does that resonate or connect with the anarchist critique of the state?
Well, for anarchists, the state is the problem, exactly the problem.
Right.
They see it as the source of so many evils, basically a channel for the egoism of a few to dominate the many.
And that applies across the board, not just specific types of government.
Yes, all forms. Doesn't matter if it's a proletarian dictatorship, a parliamentary democracy, or fascism. The force describes the state itself as inherently coercive.
A vehicle for other powers.
Exactly, a vehicle for other powers to exert their dominion through it.
Okay, so if the state is the problem from that anarchist viewpoint, how do they suggest society should organize? What's the alternative vision the source talks about?
That's the core question, isn't it? The source discusses the abolition, or at least a really drastic reduction of the state, and favoring instead decentralized, federal, community-based ways of organizing. Things like local assemblies, cooperatives, mutualism. It's about building from the ground up, really empowering communities directly.
And it's not just about tearing down, though. Anarchists aren't against all forms of control or organization.
Not at all. That's a common misconception. They actually acknowledge the need for some oversight, particularly, say, over financial activities. To prevent monopolies, to stop the appropriation of common goods, their priority is cooperation, mutual aid, rather than just an unchecked free market. And it's important to grasp that anarchism is essentially a form of socialism.
Okay.
You have figures like Benjamin Tucker, for instance, famously calling for no government of man over man and no exploitation of man by man.
And the source even positions Islam in this context as being closer to collectivism than, say, communism. That's quite a specific claim.
It is. And the distinction they seem to be drawing is that communism often applies state control over resources,
mm-hmm.
whereas collectivism, as it's viewed here, leans more towards decentralized communal ownership and decision-making.
Which aligns better with?
It aligns more closely with the Islamic emphasis on shared responsibility for resources, mutual aid within the community, not top-down state control, and not absolute individual ownership either.
What's also really interesting here is that this anarchist idea, it isn't just some modern Western thing, is it?
Not according to Kropotkin, no. He argued anarchism is an ancestral phenomenon. Its roots stretch way back, even to the Stone Age.
Really?
He believed it reflects a natural human tendency, community life without rigid government. He argued that before states became dominant, many societies naturally organized around mutual aid.
So it's a contrast.
A direct contrast to what he called the overwhelming development of authoritarianism yeah. that you see in modern governments and institutions.
Okay. That brings us neatly to the mystic part of Islam as mystic anarchism. Why use that adjective mystic? What does it add?
Well, the source explains that mystic points towards a dimension of opening to the origin, something that European political anarchism often lacks.
An opening to the origin?
Yeah, a spiritual dimension.
Yeah.
It clarifies that Islam isn't just an ideology like political anarchism might be. It's an integrated way of life.
Okay.
Oriented towards Allah and the afterlife.
Mm.
So Islam, at its heart, isn't just a set of rules. It's presented as a direct, transformative spiritual journey that's potentially accessible to everyone.
So you don't need to be, like, a Sufi or part of some specific mystical group.
Not necessarily. The idea presented is that Islam itself proposes a kind of mystical path, rooted in the Prophet Muhammad's own foundational experience.
Right, let's get into tawhid then. That's a central concept here. It means something like to make something one or reunify.
Exactly. And the source describes it as a recognition that all existence is submitted to the unique reality.
And it's called a natural condition, not just a belief system.
Precisely. Sheikh Al-Alawi put it very powerfully. Tawhid is fire.
Fire.
Yeah, transforming everything it touches into itself. So this isn't merely believing in one God, like simple monotheism. It's recognizing that this singular, uncreated reality is the ultimate truth behind all existence.
And this leads to that profound, maybe paradoxical understanding of Allah as both the hidden al-batin and the evident al-zahir. What's the significance there?
Well, the paradox means Allah is present in all visible things, yet cannot be reduced to them or associated with them.
Oh, okay.
It's like a constant movement, a refusal to be pinned down, which challenges our human tendency to limit the divine.
And that connects directly to rejecting idolatry or shirk, which is a huge theme in the Quran.
Absolutely. And it's crucial to understand, shirk isn't just about bowing to physical idols.
Right.
It extends to what the source calls the shirk of the hidden.
Which mean?
Reducing Allah to just a concept like a spiritual world or some mental category. Or, crucially, placing ultimate trust or hope in anything perishable.
Like what, for example?
Like money, family, nation, a political party, or the state itself.
Wow. So putting ultimate faith in the state is a form of shirk.
According to this perspective, yes. And the source explicitly links shirk to tyranny. Those who usurp Allah's sovereignty by claiming absolute power for themselves, they're engaged in this form of idolatry.
The example given is the Pharaoh in the Quran.
Exactly. His tyranny is shown as fundamentally religious, backed by priests, because he usurped Allah's sovereignty and basically proclaimed himself the supreme being.
So the insight is that any human claim to absolute dominion is, in a way, idolatry, a denial of that ultimate reality.
Precisely.
So the very origin of Islam, the Prophet Muhammad's experience in the Cave of Hira, that wasn't just a moment of getting some spiritual ideas.
No, it was described as a transformative encounter with the reality. And that became the foundation of Islam, leading to this path of both inner and outer liberation.
Inner and outer.
Yeah, like the Prophet's sayings, men are dreaming, and when they die, they wake up and die before dying. This deep personal experience is the root of Islam's emphasis on direct connection and liberation from illusion.
Okay, this brings us to some really striking convergences. How Islam's foundation seems to echo these anarchist principles we've discussed. First off, the source points out something quite amazing, that the Quran itself contains a radical critique of religion. That seems counterintuitive for a holy book.
It's astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah.
But the source notes the context. The Quran was revealed when Judaism and Christianity were seen by some as having become reified,
meaning
turned into rigid dogmas, often serving the status quo, the existing power structures.
Wow, okay.
So the revelation fostered this profound spiritual rupture. It encouraged a direct connection with Allah, cutting out the need for intermediaries.
And a key piece of evidence here is the Prophet Muhammad's own declaration, no monacato in Islam, no monasticism.
Exactly, which prohibits establishing a church, a formal religious hierarchy.
What's the really deep insight there for you, the listener?
The profound insight is that it asserts a radical human autonomy before Allah. It makes it crystal clear, any claim by a person or group to represent Allah or speak with absolute religious authority, that's considered shirk.
Idolatry again.
Yes. It fundamentally dismantles the whole idea of a clergy or any religious elite holding power over an individual's direct line to the divine. The Quran explicitly hits out against clerical authority, blind tradition following, and people claiming they possess the absolute truth.
Wow. Okay, now this next point. This might genuinely surprise a lot of people, especially given common perceptions of Islam today.
Mm-hmm.
The source directly challenges the idea that the Prophet Muhammad founded a modern state.
Yeah, that's a big one.
How does the source back that up?
Well, first, it argues that applying our modern concept of a state back onto 7th century Medina is just anachronistic. It doesn't fit.
Okay.
And then it points to the evidence from that time, which is pretty striking.
Yeah.
There was a notable absence of typical state institutions.
Like what specifically?
No judges in a normal system. No professional legal apparatus, no police force, no prisons, no centralized education system, no comprehensive administrative bureaucracy like we'd expect in a state.
So if those things weren't there, how were decisions made? How did that early Mednan society function?
Decisions that affected the whole community were made collectively in assemblies through consultation. The principle of shura.
Community consultation.
It's a fundamental community approach.
Yeah.
And actually, there was this influential Egyptian scholar, Ali Abd al-Razik.
Yes.
In a really controversial work back in 1924, he concluded there was basically no organized government under the Prophet. He suggested Medina's structure could almost be defined as an anarchy in that specific sense, lacking formal state structures. He just couldn't find evidence of typical government functions.
And crucially, the Ummah, the Islamic community, is presented as fundamentally different from a state. What's the core distinction there?
Well, the source highlights how the state often destroys social ties, imposes identity from the top down. Whereas a community, an Ummah, fosters those ties organically, from the bottom up. Look at the Constitution of Medina. It actually included Jewish tribes as part of the wider community, which demonstrates it wasn't some exclusive religious state imposing one identity.
Interesting.
And furthermore, the Prophet Muhammad himself often declined to get involved in purely tribal affairs, famously saying, "You know your affairs better."
Implying his authority wasn't primarily political or coercive.
Exactly. It was primarily spiritual. He didn't impose political rule over everyone who accepted him as a messenger.
Okay, this leads to a really important distinction the source wants us to grapple with. Legitimate authority versus coercive authoritarianism.
Yes.
If submission is solely to Allah, how can any human authority be legitimate?
That's the heart of it, isn't it? The source isn't saying human leadership or authority can't exist.
Okay.
There's that Quranic verse 4.59, obey Allah, obey the messenger, and those among you who have authority.
Right.
But the interpretation offered is that this refers to authority that's freely recognized because of someone's wisdom or their capability in a specific area, not imposed political power.
So it's freely accepted spiritual or moral guidance, maybe, not political rule?
That's the idea. The source is quite critical of later interpretations that tried to deduce a whole modern state structure from verses like that.
And the Quran itself insists Muhammad was just a mortal human. I am only a mortal like all of you.
Yes.
So his personal decisions, his opinions, outside of direct revelation, they could be wrong.
Absolutely. The source even cites the date palm incident.
What was that?
He apparently gave some agricultural advice about pollinating date palms. It didn't work out. The crop failed. And he admitted, essentially, I'm only human. Sometimes I'm right. Sometimes I'm wrong when it comes to worldly matters.
So obedience to him was specifically as a messenger delivering divine revelation, not as some infallible ruler in all things.
That's the point being made. And the source then criticizes how classical Islamic jurisprudence the fiqh, the body of law and interpretation that developed later,
mm-hmm.
how it often took the prophet's personal decisions or advice given in a specific context and elevated them into rigid universal laws for all time.
Which wasn't the original spirit.
Arguably not.
Yeah.
The insight here is that this practice actually ran counter to the spirit of free inquiry and debate he seemed to encourage. Remember the hadith. Divergence of opinion in the Ummah is a mercy of Allah.
Right, embracing difference rather than demanding uniformity.
Exactly. So a dynamic, evolving interpretation got kind of replaced by rigidity over time, according to this analysis.
Okay, so with that understanding of authority, how was justice handled in this early community? How did they approach law without state courts and police?
Well, the anarchist idea, which finds an echo in Islam, according to the source, is that real justice is kind of innate. It's natural. It's not something artificially constructed by the state or its legal experts.
Like William Godwin said.
Right. The anarchist pioneer Godwin said, "The function of the community is not to make, but to interpret the law."
Interpret, not make. Interesting.
So instead of state tribunals, the source points to community-based judgment, respected individuals mediating disputes, much like Tolstoy envisioned it. There's this idea of a natural sense of fairness that exists before and maybe even transcends state-made laws.
And Kropotkin's argument fits here too, doesn't it? That society itself bears responsibility for antisocial acts and that punishment in prisons often just make things worse.
Absolutely relevant. The source emphasizes that early Medina didn't operate with some pre-written Sharia code dropped from the sky.
How did it work then?
Norms developed through revelation, yes, but also through the prophet's contextual deductions in specific situations, always with an emphasis on social justice, on finding equilibrium.
And the prophet wasn't a judge in our modern sense.
Not really. He would judge disputes when people brought them to him, asked him to. But he emphasized his role as an arbiter by request, not someone holding a formal office. He even acknowledged his own fallibility in judging, suggesting these were his best human deductions. Not necessarily divine pronouncements in every case.
Fascinating. Okay, thinking about these principles of authority and justice,
yeah.
How did they translate into economics? Economic justice, ownership of resources.
The source really frames early Islam as a social and spiritual movement, deeply committed to justice. There's that incredibly powerful hadith.
Which one?
Allah has established the provisions of the poor in the haciendas or wealth of the rich. If exist hungry and naked, it is due to the transgressions of the rich.
Wow, that's strong.
It really is. And this conviction led to a whole series of economic principles that align quite well with anarchist ideals, as the source presents it.
Such as?
The prohibition of usury, riba, limits on accumulating private property just for the sake of it, avoiding monopolies, condemning speculation, excessive luxury, and hoarding wealth.
So an economy based more on real production and fair distribution.
That's the goal, not just artificial accumulation of wealth.
And there's a very strong emphasis on manual labor, the dignity of work.
Huge emphasis. The story of the prophet kissing the rough hands of a manual laborer.
Yes.
And the instruction, pay the workers their wages before the fruit of their sweat dries. It shows deep respect for labor.
And property itself is viewed differently too, isn't it?
Completely differently from modern capitalism. Allah is seen as the ultimate owner of everything. Humans are just caliphs, stewards, trustees.
So property isn't an absolute right.
No. It means property is for responsible use for the common good. Not for absolute disposal, however you please, there's that principle. The only legitimate possessor of a land is the one who works it.
That sounds profoundly libertarian, actually, emphasizing active use over just passive ownership.
It really does.
And this idea of stewardship, it even extended to protecting the environment.
Yes, remarkably so for the time. The prophet established Hema-protected natural zones.
Like early conservation areas?
Essentially, yes. It shows an early ecological awareness. This idea that natural resources have rights, in a sense, and must be preserved for the common benefit. Though Rahman even mentions that animals form communities just like humans do.
Incredible. Okay, finally, let's tackle jihad. This word is so loaded, so misunderstood. What does the source clarify about it in this context of mystic anarchism?
Yeah, it's crucial to get this right. The source is very clear. Jihad fundamentally means effort or struggle.
Effort against what?
A constant combat against injustice. And that injustice can be internal, the struggle for self-improvement, spiritual purification, the greater jihad.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be external, the struggle against social injustice, oppression, the lesser jihad.
Yeah.
Is the hadith. Whoever among you sees an injustice, let him rectify it with his hand.
Okay.
If he cannot, then with his tongue. If he cannot, then with his heart. And this the heart is the weakest of submission or faith.
So every Muslim is called to be a mujahid in that sense, a combatant for justice.
That's the implication, yes. Mm. A struggler against injustice in all its forms.
And what about armed jihad, the fighting aspect?
The source stresses, based on the Quran, that armed jihad is strictly for self-defense, and it explicitly prohibits aggression.
There's a specific verse.
Yes, Quran 2.190. And combat for the cause of Allah, those who combat you, but do not commit aggression, for verily Allah does not love aggressors.
So clearly distinct from offensive warfare or modern terrorism.
Absolutely. It's presented as a purely defensive posture against active oppression or attack.
So wrapping this section up, the source concludes that both Islam, in this understanding, and anarchism are fundamentally incompatible with the state.
Right. Because the state is seen as this machinery of exclusion. It imposes identity, it imposes control. Both traditions, in their own ways, question the whole narrative of linear progress of Western exceptionalism.
They're both challenging the system itself, really, advocating for a totally different way of organizing human life.
Yep.
Wow, what an incredible journey through these ideas. We've really seen how this perspective, Islam as mystic anarchism, offers just a profound challenge to so many established norms.
It really does. It advocates for a community, the Ummah, that's rooted in liberation, in mutual aid, and crucially, in that direct submission only to reality, to Allah.
Rather than submission to human authority or even to a rigid institutionalized religion.
Precisely. It's a vision of human flourishing that's somehow both radically autonomous and deeply communal at the same time.
It's a call, isn't it, to understand that maybe the deepest forms of resistance against oppressive systems, paradoxically, might be these acts of ultimate surrender.
Surrender to that singular uncreated reality.
Yeah.
It's about realizing the inherent unreality or transience of worldly powers, and through that realization, liberating yourself from their grip.
So, here's something to leave you with. If true freedom lies not in breaking all bonds, but maybe in recognizing and submitting only to the ultimate reality, does that imply that the deepest rebellion against oppressive systems is maybe paradoxically a spiritual act,
yeah,
an act of ultimate surrender?
And what would a society built on those principles actually look like today?
Mm.
And maybe more personally, how might you, listening now, begin to cultivate those kinds of liberated spaces in your own life, in your own communities?